this same story, if you will, the Sermon on the Mount text, in a somewhat different form, is also found in the book of Luke. And so in the beginning of chapter 5, you'll find where it says, "And seeing the multitudes, he went into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him." Now, here's why that's important. Jesus is not taking these multitudes, his popularity, and it's not going to his head. He's still about business. And so he went to the mountain not to find a great platform from which to say great words. He went to the mountain to escape the people, to escape the press of the people, so that he could have a private audience with a select few. At this point in time, and in this reading of the Sermon on the Mount, he has not yet chosen all of his disciples. If you look a couple verses or chapters over, he's actually going to choose Matthew as he finds him in his tax collecting booth. And so Jesus has something he wants to say. And he gathers into the mountain just the disciples that he's chosen up to that point and a select few of those who are following him. Why is that important? It's important because Jesus is about to reveal to us the very first thing that he wants to say in his public ministry. And this is also not in response to someone jeering him. This is not in response to someone challenging him, goading him into an argument. This is what Jesus has to say de novo. This is what's on his mind. This is what's on his heart. And so therefore, it inherently has significance. And so in the first 12 verses, you see how Jesus is getting their attention by letting them know right off the bat that his ministry is going to go against the grain. He's not against the Jews. He's not against the law. However, the way that they had come to fashion the law and think about themselves in relation to the law and to God is off. And so their first clue of this is what biblically we have come to call the Beatitudes, how you ought to be, and what would be blessed in God's eyes, or who would be blessed in God's eyes. And as you go through them, you'll see that these are not the kind of people, these are not the situations, these are not the circumstances where they had come to believe equates to being blessed. So when he says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," that doesn't quite jive. That doesn't make sense to their ears. And he said, "Blessed are they that mourn." Jesus came for the underdog, not those that had it all, you know, all that. But he came for those who did not feel that they were represented, who did not feel that they counted or mattered. "Blessed are the meek." We would call that person weak. But Jesus says they will be blessed, for they shall inherit the earth. He goes on in verse 6 to say, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they will be healed." There were those who felt that they were already righteous by virtue of their acts, their actions, their rituals. But Jesus came for those who were hungering and thirsting after true righteousness, which comes from God. He goes on to say, "Blessed are the merciful." And this is not the way they thought. They wanted to conquer, and conquest matters. Winning mattered. Domination mattered. But this merciful thing doesn't quite make sense to them, despite their having the law and God's wisdom for all these centuries. He says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." This is not where their heads were at, this issue of peacemaking. They frankly realized this, by the way. They were under the dominion of the Romans. And they were always thinking and plotting to overthrow the Romans. So for Jesus to come along, and especially if he is to be called the Messiah, the deliverer, they're looking for an earthly deliverer. And so for him to come and call peacemakers blessed, that's not going to quite ring true for everyone in the audience. And then it only gets tougher for the listeners at the time, where he says, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Now, I'll tell you, when you read the version in Luke, he will be talking directly to them. So you will reword it, and he's saying, they are mourners and poor, and they, blessed are they when they are reviled and persecuted. Because he's talking to his disciples. He's not talking to the masses. He's talking to his disciples. And so, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And here is where he does address them directly, even in Matthew's account. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you. Now, why would that be a blessed thing? And shall say all manner of evil against you falsely. So people are going to lie on you, and somehow or another, you're blessed. All of this will happen for my sake, Jesus says. And then to make it make even less sense to the natural mind, he says, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great, and this is where you get the payback, is your reward in heaven, because they persecuted the prophets the same way. Now, most of us would love to be counted alongside the great prophets of the Bible, the prophets of old. Most of us would love to be mentioned in the same sentence as Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, Ezekiel, etc. But how many of us would count it all joy when we find ourselves suffering the same fate that they did, being persecuted and many times also killed? And so the point here is that Jesus is from the very beginning letting us know and letting them know that I'm going to come against the grain. I'm not coming with the same old thing. I'm not going to fulfill your vision of what the Messiah is supposed to be. But then he goes in verse 13 and he begins to engage them. Now that he's let them know where he's coming from, now he's engaging them directly. And understand that all of these men would be Jews. All of them would come from the people that were the caretakers of and beneficiaries of God's word all these centuries. And so he says to them in verse 13, and this is our main text, ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is this forth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. And this is where we get our subject and title of saltiness. Saltiness. The people of Israel were supposed to be the salt of the earth. And so what might Jesus mean by this? In their case, there were two key applications of salt. At the time, because this predates refrigeration methods, salt was the main way of preserving foods and in particular meats. But also salt has always been a seasoning for food. And it gave it flavor as opposed to it being bland. And so Jesus is saying that the children of Israel were supposed to be the preservatives for the earth because of what they were exposed to and who they were exposed to. But also their job was to inject a flavor into the peoples of the earth that could only come from God. We're talking about saltiness. Now, most of the time in my upbringing, when we look at this saltiness, we tend to think that it means we're supposed to be different. It means we're supposed to be separate. Try eating salt by itself. I think that you would end up with a pretty ugly face. And that is not the way we are supposed to salt the earth. We are supposed to preserve it, and we are supposed to inject flavor into it. But not just a different flavor. This is not a call to being different. This is actually, and if you use the translations from the Greek, it is to lose your savor is to become bland, but not bland as opposed to any flavor, but it's your distinctiveness. It was supposed to have a distinct flavor, a distinct impact. And so if they lost their savor, if they lost the ability, the power to manifest on earth through their relationship with God, the purpose for which they were exposed to God in the first place, then they are useless. Useless. And so as the illustration goes, if salt has no saltiness, no flavor, then it's so pointless that you may as well just throw it away. And this was not just to drop it on the floor. That word in the Greek means to hurl away and to be trodden upon by men. That trotting is an intentional trotting. This is not just somebody happening along to step on it. And so Jesus is challenging them, letting them know their place in the order of things. And it must be terrible if the salt loses its saltiness. Well, the problem is that at this point in time, the people of Israel had indeed lost their saltiness. They were no longer fulfilling the promise and the purpose for which God exposed himself to them and connected himself to them all these years. They had the law. They had the writings of the prophets. And they felt like, well, we've got our distinctive history. We've had the law that God gave to us. That makes us different. That makes us special. So aren't we salty enough? Well, they were not, because they had perverted God's word. They had perverted his law. And so the scribes and the Pharisees, those who were the main leaders from a religious standpoint, were not guiding the people in the proper way so that they can manifest what God intended through the law. We're going to come back to that. But let's take a quick look at what Jesus says after that. So they're the salt, and we're talking about mainly saltiness. But in verse 14, he says, you're also the light of the world. And he says, a city that's set upon a hill cannot be hid. He goes on to say, neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. And so he challenges them to let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Now, here is the thing. It's not going to be very helpful if you shine a light, but the light illuminates you, but not God. And it's also not going to do any good if you carry the treasures of God and you don't shine the light. Either way, if you're up on the hill, you're going to be visible. The question is, what do the people see? What does the earth of peoples that you are supposed to infect with your godliness, what do they see? Do they see a mere reflection of who they already are? Do they see a slightly altered version of them and all of their problems of sin that they have already? Or do they see God, a God that lets us know our sinful nature and yet embraces us with his grace and mercy? What is it that they see when they look at the church of today? What is it that they see if they walk up here in For God's Glory Ministries? What is it that they see and experience if they're walking alongside or engaged in something alongside us? How salty is the church today? He was talking to the children of Israel here, but by extension, we are now the bearers of that torch. And so the question is, have we lost our saltiness? Has the church become bland? That doesn't mean boring. That doesn't mean that. It means to lose the distinctive flavor and ingredient and the distinctive impact that you were called and purposed to have. Have we lost that? Have we gotten like the Church of Laodicea, too blended in, too high tech, too accepted, too popular to actually have an impact? Why is it that people can drive by a million churches and have no real impact upon themselves? Why is it that we can fill the pews of huge churches and still have all the problems of sin all around us? Why is it that you can have huge cathedrals packed and still walk right outside there, go one block away when the service is gone and we don't speak to each other? Why is it? Maybe we've lost our saltiness. So this is the challenge that Jesus is putting before his disciples. Because if you're going to roll with him, you need to have your saltiness factor. And this is what he's trying to teach them. Now, the way that we're going to come to fully understand this saltiness, because one might ask, well, what does it look like? We can talk about what it's not. We can feel for shame about the fact that we're not manifesting it. But saltiness is not what one might think. The scribes and Pharisees thought they were being very salty. They had their long list of rules and regulations, and they purported to try to live out those rules and to judge others and call others to do the same. So they thought that they were salty. And so this is striking and surprising to them that Jesus is coming along and saying, you've lost your sense of purpose. You are not living out the purpose for which Yahweh God called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to bring a people that he would call his very own. So how do we come to understand what Jesus is meaning by this lack of saltiness? Well, if we look at verse 17, he says, think not that I am come to destroy the law, because everything that he was saying would make them believe, because certain things that he said, they knew, really alluded to things that were contained in the law. He says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy it, but to fulfill it. Now, we tend to think about merely the fact that Jesus came to fulfill the fact that all of the Old Testament pointed toward a Redeemer, and that he would be born and that he would die and be resurrected for our remission of sins. There is no question about that. But what Jesus is also saying is that he comes to explain to them what they could not figure out for themselves. He comes to really reveal to them what the law was trying to do in them all along. He's coming to explain to them how the law was meant to change them on the inside so that then they can match that with Jesus' outward work when he came here on earth. And so, yes, it is important to try to live by God's laws, but only if you live them from the inside out. And all of that living and all of that giving and all of that loving only matters in the end if Jesus' sacrifice is matched with it. But Jesus' sacrifice is also of none effect if you are not one that can be called his. And what they would have thought prior to Jesus coming is that the scribes and the Pharisees would be first in line. But what does he say in verse 20? He says, "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." Now, I didn't say that. Jesus said that. Unless your righteousness exceed the righteousness of those who are dressing the part, those who are doing all of the rituals, those who are making sure they only hardly even breathe on the Sabbath. Unless you are better than that. Now they're saying, how can we be better than those guys? They wear the long robes. They have all the right garb. They know all the right things to say. They utter the most beautiful prayers in public. How? They know the Torah inside out. They can quote the prophets. How can we have a righteousness that exceeds theirs? Well, Jesus understood that they would have these questions. And so for the remainder of our time, I'm going to try to be as brief as I can, but as you know, it's difficult for me not to reveal the word as it really ought to be to you, but we're going to see if we can do justice to the rest of this chapter and as quickly as possible. So Jesus began to answer this question. What is saltiness like? We know that the scribes and the Pharisees were not providing the proper salt. And so he says, and understand that what he's about to do. He's just said, I didn't come to destroy the law. Let me just prepare you to listen to me properly. I didn't come to destroy it. I came to fulfill it. And so he says, ye have heard in verse 21, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. So we know this is one of the Ten Commandments. That's easy to say. Most of us have not killed anyone. But let me just prepare you for something. I see that some of us have open-toe shoes and some have closed-toe shoes. Now, you know, if you're standing in line and you're standing at attention and you look down at your shoes, they're supposed to be shiny. Well, if you had shoes like that, by the time we're done, nobody's shoes are going to be clean. Every toe will be stepped on by the time Jesus finishes talking about saltiness. So just get prepared. Don't get too high-minded. You might make it through a few of these, but somewhere along the way, we're all going to be touched. We're all going to say, ouch, a little bit. So he makes it rather easy on us in the beginning, and so it seems, as he talks about, thou shalt not kill. So they would say, well, yeah, of course, thou shalt not kill. We get that. That's one of the great Ten Commandments brought by our great prophet and deliverer, Moses. But Jesus begins the education here. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Wow, that's pretty deep. So the point is, you don't have to kill somebody physically. You can either harm them verbally or hold on to your anger, hold on to your hurt, hold on to your misgivings. Jesus is saying there are certain precursors that ultimately lead to the act of murder. Jesus is saying that you need to be salty from the inside out. And so even if You haven't killed anyone. You're still not salty just because you can say, I haven't killed anyone. And so he goes on to make it very clear what he means by this, where if indeed you said these terrible things to your brother, if indeed you're holding on to an ought, then he goes on to illustrate exactly how significant it is. In verse 23, he says, therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and then remember that your brother has ought against you, leave that gift there. Go back and get it right with your brother. God does not need your gift that bad for you to come and not have yourself right and to know that you're not right and for you not to go fix it. He'd rather you go fix it first. Because the gift is only as good as the relationship and the status of the giver. We're not talking about perfection here, as in no flaws, but we're talking about the quality, the character of the one when it's combined with Jesus' sacrificial act equals heaven bound. That's the key. Jesus died for everyone ahead of us that are yet born. He died for us now, and he died for everybody back then. That was their hope. And so Jesus dying, that ingredient will always be available. So the only thing left in question is, who are we? Whose are we? Are we indeed the salt of the earth? The next thing he goes on to say in verse 25 is, agree with thine adversary quickly. And by the way, Brother Marcellus, you know, these legal examples, they just come up. I don't have anything to do with it. They just come up. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. What is he saying here? You have an adversary, meaning one who is planning to accuse you. There's an inference here that you are guilty and that you likely know that. Your job should be to settle out of court while you have a chance, and not to be so puffed up and haughty and proud and win at any cost. This is the problem, or can be the problem, with the pure advocacy system. Win at any cost. Well, is it a win if I lower my pride? Is it a win if I admit the truth? Is it a win if I engage the one for whom there presumably has been a hurt by me? Is that a victory? If you can't see victory in reconciliation, if you can't see victory in peacemaking, then you will not manifest godly saltiness. You've got to get over yourself. You've got to get past pride. This is what Jesus is teaching in the context of the commandments. Understand, he did not come to destroy them. He came to fulfill them, and clearly here to a select few fully explain them. So you should agree with your adversary quickly while you have a chance. Why? Because if you have your pride in the forefront, there will be no mercy. Make peace while you can. Don't ask God to deliver you later after your stubbornness. Your hard head has made a soft behind, as my mother would say. So Jesus is teaching us what it is we're supposed to be about, what it is we're supposed to be like, if we are to be the salt of the earth, if we are to fulfill the promise and the calling of the ingredient that we are supposed to inject into the meat that is the peoples of the earth. And so he goes on. He says, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. Another one that most people say, I got that one. I haven't done that. I haven't slept with anyone that's not my husband or wife. They're referring mainly to the men here, as it tends to happen biblically. But Jesus is saying, okay, that's an easy one, right? Nice softball I'm throwing you. Big grapefruit, piece of cake. Thou shalt not commit adultery. But then he gets you, like he always does. He says, but I say to you that whosoever looketh upon a woman, and it goes the other way, by the way, ladies, to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. So, how many of us can say that we have never committed adultery now? How many of us can say that they've never let themselves go from, oh, you know, she's cute. He's cute. She's fine. Ooh, he's built. She's sweet. He's got a great personality. And began to go across that line of imagining what it might be to connect with that person. How many of us can say that we've never crossed the line, breached the line, that went past the full fidelity, loyalty, and respect of one to whom you are betrothed? Or that you have never crossed the line with one who is betrothed to another? Jesus is saying that you need to be salty from the inside out. And the outward act with the scribes and Pharisees might be able to say that either they haven't done or no one knows that they've done it. That's called righteousness. If I can walk around and look like I've got it all together and I haven't done any of the big things, then I'm good. And that's the problem today with our media, where we see big ministers and preachers fall from grace, from high places. Because really what we call righteousness is if you look the part, if you sound like the part, and nobody knows, and you haven't done one of the biggies, then you are considered righteous. But this is not the saltiness that Jesus is calling us to. He says you need to be salty from the inside out. And so if you have a problem with looking at the other sex when they don't belong to you, then you need to pluck your eyes out, is what Jesus says. If you have a problem with your hands, you need to cut your arms off. If you need to take other people's stuff or touch people that you shouldn't be touching, doing things, whatever it is that you do that you know you shouldn't be doing, the point is you're better off without those parts of your body in heaven than you are with a full body going to hell. This is Jesus talking, not me. And so Jesus is saying, I can see past your exterior. I can see into the inside, and that's what I'm judging. So all this time, when you've been taking the law and perverting it and adding rule on top of rule on top of rule on top of rule, and so therefore what was already difficult to live up to, you make impossible. And yet you walk around acting like you're the salt, acting like you were the beacon on the hill, when frankly, no one should come and try to emulate the light that you shine. And so what does Jesus say next after he, and by the way, he said hell, okay? He says, it hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. Uh-oh. Anybody's shoes clean so far? I don't know. He should give her a writing of divorcement. This is literally the law. This is technically the law. So whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. Wow. Now you got to understand some things or else this can be really misinterpreted. what he's talking about here was that this writing of divorcement comes in a situation, first of all, understand that all the way up to this time, even though it was in disfavor at this point, which is why when they talk about bishops and they talk about elders, they say a husband of one wife is one of the criteria. This is not about marriage and divorce. It's one wife. You've got one wife to deal with you and for you to deal with. But it was still legal to have more than one wife. But a man, all the way up to this time, according to the law, could put away his wife for any reason. This is not an equal society. This is not a level playing field society. Okay? And so he could put her away for any reason. He didn't like the way she looked. He didn't like the way she cooked. He didn't like the way she laughed. He didn't like whatever, the way she smelled, doesn't matter. He could put her away. The writing of divorcement was to not level the playing field completely, but it was to allow this woman, as she is now thrown into society, out of the protective arms of her husband, out of the provision of her husband. How does she fend for herself? This writing of divorcement allowed her to have just enough measure of dignity and respect to re-enter society. It also made it possible for her to be accepted into another man's household so as not to languish, to be poor and destitute the rest of her life. This was the least the man could do if he was going to throw her away. This was legal. The point is this, is everything that's legal expedient? Paul said something's unlawful but not expedient. Is it a good thing that just because you can, you would just throw these women away after you committed yourself to them? Is that okay just because technically the law said you could? It was there for a purpose. It wasn't there to be abused, and yet it was abused. And for the man, no problem. He already had the right to marry multiple wives, so all he had to do if he wanted to is just marry another one. It's not a one-on-one thing at this time. So what is Jesus saying? He's saying, yeah, in the law, I come here to fulfill it. I don't come here to destroy it, but I know it said you can do that. But let me just tell you, if you throw her away like that, it's not legitimate in my eyes. Not legitimate in my eyes. And so therefore, it's as if she's married. So whoever has sex with her, whoever bonds with her, they're committing adultery and you're causing her to commit adultery. We're talking about the character that's supposed to be commensurate with those that are called and purposed to be the salt of the earth, that are supposed to be different, distinctively different, not just different, not just separate. Separateness does no good. How, if your salt is separate, all you get is an ugly face? You're supposed to be intermingled with the earth that you're supposed to be salting, but you ought to have a distinctive flavor and a distinctive impact. And if not, you are, the Bible says, useless. That's not even neutral. It said you ought to be hurled away and trodden upon intentionally. Jesus is serious here. In his loving way, but yet with a command presence, he's speaking with authority. He is letting them know what the law was supposed to really be about. It had not, unfortunately, had this internal effect on them. So they focused only on the outward, which is why Jesus was so controversial. So he says, again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. I'll just skip right on over and say, he says in verse 37, but let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whosoever is more than these cometh of evil. The point is this. Remember, the commandments. We talked a little bit about them last week. And the third commandment says, thou shalt not take the Lord thy God's name in vain. And one of the main interpretation of that is that you shouldn't be swearing by God's name, which, boy, if you do that, the veracity of what you're saying should be not in question, right? You are telling the truth. You are dependable. You are loaning this to me. I swear to God I'm going to pay you back. So the Bible says in the third commandment in Exodus 20 that you should not say that and not fulfill it because you are harming the name, the reputation, the image of God. So Jesus is saying, I know the law said that. I know it allows you to swear by God, but I'm telling you, you shouldn't swear by anything. I'm telling you what they had done is, remember I told you how they actually took this particular commandment and decided, hey, if I never say his name, then I'm good. If I never say Yahweh, if I never pronounce it, if I only write it with four little letters, right, then I'm good. Technicalities. These are a people of technicalities. Jesus is saying it's about the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law, and these technicalities and loopholes, Jesus is not a God of loopholes. This is him talking. And so he is letting them know that you should not swear by anything. Don't swear by your own head, because you know what? You can't change it from white to black. You don't own yourself. Don't swear by anything, because really, you don't own anything. So don't swear by anything. Just let your word be your bond. That's what he's saying here. So we're talking about the character of those who are the saltiness of the earth. The character, the inner workings that the law was meant to change, and Jesus comes in to change. And so if your feet haven't gotten stepped on yet, we move on, although we are close to the end. He says, ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye. It gets a lot more difficult, by the way, as we end here. And a tooth for a tooth. This is biblical. This is literally snatched from the book of Leviticus, as the rest of these things are. Literally, this is the law, the written law that was given to Moses. How could you go against that? Well, he's not destroying it. He's fulfilling it. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on one cheek, you turn and offer them the other. All right. Can we handle that? Are all the shoes clean still? The Bible said an eye for an eye. Why did it say that? It said that to establish the understanding that when you do something evil, you actually deserve an equal and opposite impact, or the equal impact, rather. So if you harm someone, you deserve to have to pay equally. There are way too many legal angles to this thing. I didn't write it though, so. You deserve to be taken care of. But Jesus says, no, don't resist evil. Now that may not hit your ears right. How can I not resist evil? I thought we're supposed to resist the devil and he will flee. I thought we're supposed to try to destroy evil. So what is he saying? You come to understand what he's saying by remembering the context and understanding that he is talking about the inner character of the salty ones. So then, with that understanding, what do we think he's saying? He is saying here that, yes, we wanted to point out, just like with the law, we wanted to show you your sinfulness. So if you do something, it should come back to you. That's what you deserve. But we shouldn't resist evil simply because what it means is it means returning evil for evil. It means that you have to get right there in the ring and get all muddy and dirty and ugly, just like the one that came at you. And this is not going to show the world a shining light that reflects and reveals and draws them closer to God. If we're just like the rest, wanting our redress on any subject matter where we have an ought, wanting our rights to be taken care of at all costs, no matter what, fighting on technicalities in society and at home. This is not saltiness as Jesus is calling for. And so he says, offer them the other cheek. This gets to be challenging, but what if all of these things were a reflection of who we are? Will we be different? Absolutely. We would not need to be separate because we want to impact the world, but we would certainly be distinctive. We would certainly have people say, boy, you're different. You would certainly have people start to ask you, what is it about you? They're not going to ask you that in a constructive way if all you do is call yourself separate and you shout and make noise and sing songs and dance on Sundays. And that's all that you do and call yourself holy. Come out from among them and be separate does not mean, certainly in our day and time, to not intermingle and be the salt of the earth. You can't help anyone if you don't engage them. And you're going to see, we're not quite done. We're almost there, but you're going to see exactly what I'm talking about. So, again, I attempted to apologize for the legal emphasis here, but I didn't write it. This is in red. Jesus is talking. He says, after he says, offer them the other cheek. And if any man will sue thee at the law, in the court of law, and take away your coat, let him have your cloak too. It could be the dead of winter, and they sue you. And so then, therefore, they deserve redress, and they take some of your property. Offer them the other part of it. Might be the dead of winter, and they take your coat, offer them your cloak too. Wow. What is this saying? Jesus is saying you ought to be different. Understand, and actually if we went to the next chapter, we would see how Jesus says, don't be worried about what you're going to eat. Don't be worried about how you're going to live. Don't be worried about how you're going to be taken care of. Don't I take care of the birds? Don't I take care of all of the rest of nature? Stop worrying about how you're going to make it. Our inability to live up to this saltiness is all because we are worried about how we're going to make it, number one. And number two, we don't want anybody to get over on us. How can anybody truly get over on us when the ledger, when you actually end up adding it up, you're not done until God's line item is added in? And so since God's ability and provision is infinite, then you can never lose. But we don't live in that mindset. We don't want anybody to get over on us. And so he says, if they sue you and take your coat, give them your cloak too. Can we live up to that? Can we live up to that component, that aspect of saltiness that Jesus, the Mashiach, the Messiah, the Anointed One, our Savior, happened to say in his first discourse, meaning this is what was inside of him that matters, that he wants us to know. Can we handle this? Can we handle this kind of saltiness? It's a good question. He goes on to say further, and whosoever shall compel you to go 1 mile, go a second mile with him. Go two. Go 2 miles. Don't just do the minimum. Give more. Remember, this is coming from a place of plenty. There is a way of thinking that is a scarcity thinking. The same thing plays out in business. But if you operate from a place of believing that there's more where that came from, you operate differently. How do we operate? Do we operate in scarcity thinking or plentiful thinking? Frankly, most of the time it's scarcity. But even when it's not an issue of not having enough, we care about the principle of the matter. We care about the technicality. We don't want anybody to get over on us. We want to win at any cost. And God is calling us away from the me and mine, win at any cost thinking. I've got to win. It's about me. It's about mine. It's about getting more and more. And he's calling us away from this. We're almost done. He says, give to him that asketh thee. And from him, so first of all, give to him that asketh thee. So if somebody asks you for something, you ought to give it to him. And from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Wow. Now we want to qualify that and say, well, no, Lord, some people I shouldn't be giving. But this is Jesus talking. He's talking about saltiness. And, certainly if we operated on these principles consistently, we would be distinctive. We would be an ingredient that would be easy to taste in the meat. We would always know when God's people are involved. Those people seem to have a limitless supply. You try to do them and they say, fine, whatever, take it. My God's got me. But we don't, because in truth, we believe that our provision comes from the same place that theirs comes from. We believe it comes from the bank account. We believe it comes from the legal settlement. We believe it comes from the job. We believe it comes from our spouse. We believe it comes from our parent. That's where we really believe it comes from. So it leaves us no different than the others. It leaves us without saltiness, without flavor. It leaves us bland, not living up to the calling and the purpose that God came to have a relationship with us to fulfill. Now, he's almost done, and he says, ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate your enemy. This goes to that Good Samaritan story, because for them, a neighbor meant another Jewish brother. And it was all right to hate the Samaritan. This is way before the challenge from the lawyer that led Jesus to give the Good Samaritan story, but Jesus was thinking this way all along. This wasn't new. So hate thine enemy, but I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love them that love you, then what reward have ye? Don't even the publicans do that? So while you're trying to consider whether or not you're salty or not, if you're trying to plead your case, if you're really not hearing Jesus and you want to fight, because you got to win, because you're stubborn. You can't just give in. You can't just be humble. You can't just let go. Then he's measuring you up against the lowest of the low in society, the most hated people in society, in Jewish society in the first century, the publicans. So, all right, if you want to measure up your righteousness, your saltiness, well, if you hate those that hate you because you feel like that's justified, well, the publicans do that. You love those that love you, then, oh, that's great. You're just a loving person. Well, it's all qualified. Come on now. So Jesus says, come on. You're not even, forget about the scribes and the Pharisees. You can't even get above the bar set by the publicans. You've got to love those that I love. And so if God connects with us and loves us and provides for us, and blesses us so that then we can bless others. if we choose only to extend God's love to those who love us, then what good is that? Are we then no longer qualified to be the emissaries, the ambassadors, the tools of God? Because the tool, the hammer, the saw, the nail is supposed to go where the carpenter says so. And it's supposed to have the impact and the effect that the carpenter has decided. And so if Jesus chooses to reign and provide sunshine and provision for the just and the unjust, this is the same criteria we're supposed to use if indeed we are going to be fulfilling our calling of saltiness. Now, if you don't want to be salty, you just want to be you. I just want to do me. Okay, then do you. But when people look upon the hill, the beacon that they see will be a reflection of just another sinful man. We're supposed to be better than that. The calling of having the oracles and the companionship and the shepherdhood of God is supposed to reflect in us that we are different, distinctive, special, not just set apart unto itself. Salt doesn't taste very good all by itself. And so he says he reigns on the just and the unjust, and because that's how he operates, we're supposed to operate the way he operates. Right? So we are a reflection of him. And then he goes on to say, and we're just about done. And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than the others? The publicans do that too. So if you're walking down the street, you only speak to those that you know. You only speak to those that look like you. You only speak to those that you want to speak to. You only salute those, you only give. And I suppose, really, to be honest, we're not necessarily talking about totally stranger situations. But the point is that you're only connected to those that you choose to. You're only connected to those that are like you. You only care about those that are close to you, that are one of you. And we talked about this when we talked about the difference between humanitarianism and philanthropy and giving to people and into the world as an emissary of God. There is a difference because God gets the glory when we do something for him. So he goes on to say the publicans do that. But ye therefore be perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Here we mean maturing. Obviously, we cannot be perfect, but in the end, the message here is that we should be attempting to emulate God. It is God that wants the earth to be salted, and he has chosen to use us. And so my hope, and certainly the hope of Jesus at the time and even now, is that you now understand what saltiness is about. You now understand that the goal is for us to manifest God from the inside out. The goal is for us to get past a me and mine, I got to have more, I need to win thought process. Now, we live in a society that is all about that. It's all about survival of the fittest. It's all about picking yourself up by your bootstraps and whoever wins, wins. The question is, can we be distinctively different? Is the church distinctively different in the world? Is For God's Glory Ministries distinctively different in our environment? Are we as individuals distinctively different? Are we as individuals fulfilling the promise that's been invested in us to reflect and manifest God and his holiness and his righteousness? Our righteousness is but filthy rags. But if we have the godly character, as Jesus has described it here, certainly if we aspire to it, if we seek to be that, then when you combine that with the matchless power and the wonderment that is in the name of Jesus, we can really have the impact in the world that God intended.